not talking until I pick up my coat. Then she says, Victor, she says, I need to tell you something. She's rolling a ball of lint between her fingers, rolling it smaller and tighter, and when she finally looks up at me, she says, Fred Hastings was here. You remember Fred, don't you? Yeah, I remember. These days, he has a wife and two perfect children. It was such a pleasure, my mom says, to see life work out for such a good person. I told him to buy land, my mom says. They're not making it anymore. I ask her who she means by they, and she presses the nurse button again. On my way out, I find Dr. Marshall waiting in the hallway. She's standing just outside my mom's door, leafing through notes on her clipboard, and she looks up at me, her eyes beady behind thick glasses. Her one hand is clicking and unclicking a ballpoint pen, fast. Mr. Mancini, she says. She folds her glasses and puts them in the chest pocket of her lab coat and says, It's important we discuss your mother's case. The stomach tube. You ask about other options, she says. From the nurse's station down the hallway, three staffers watch us, their heads tilted together. One named Dinah says, Do we need to chaperone the two of you? And Dr. Marshall says, Mind your own business, please. To me, she whispers, These small operations, the staff acts as if we're all still in high school. Dinah, I've had. See also Claire, RN. See also Pearl, CNA. The magic of sex is its acquisition without the burden of possessions. No matter how many women you take home, there's never a storage problem. To Dr. Marshall, her ears and nervous hands, I say, I don't want my mom force-fed. The nurse is still watching. Dr. Marshall cups a hand behind my arm and walks me farther away from them, saying, I've been talking to your mother. She's quite a woman. Her political actions, all her demonstrations, you must love her very much. And I say, well, I wouldn't go as far as that. We stop, and Dr. Marshall whispers something, so I have to lean closer to hear. Too close. The nurse is still watching, and breathing against my chest, she says, What if we could completely restore your mother's mind? Clicking and unclicking her pen, Dr. Marshall says, What if we could make her the intelligent, strong, vibrant woman she used to be? My mother, the way she used to be. It may be possible, says Dr. Marshall. And not thinking how it sounds, I say, God forbid. Then real fast, I say that's probably not such a good idea. And down the hall, the nurses are laughing, their hands cupped over their mouths. And from even that far away, you can hear Dinah say, It would serve him right. On my next visit, I'm still Fred Hastings, and my kids both get straight A's in school. That week, Mrs. Hastings is painting our dining room green. Blue is better, my mom says, for a room you're going to put any sort of food into. After that, the dining room is blue. We live on East Pine Street. We're Catholics. We save our money at City First Federal. We drive a Chrysler, all at my mom's suggestion. The next week, I start writing things down, the details, so I won't forget who I'm supposed to be from one week to the next. The Hastings always drive to Robson Lake for our vacations. I write, We fish for steelhead. We want the Packers to win. We never eat oysters. We were buying land. Each Saturday, I first sit in the day room and study my notes while the nurse goes to see if my mom is awake. Whenever I step into her room and introduce myself as Fred Hastings, she points the remote control to turn the television off. Boxwoods around a house are fine, she tells me, but privets would be better, and I write it down. The best kind of people drink scotch, she says. Clean your gutters in October, then again in November, she says. Wrap your car's air filter in toilet paper for longer service life. Prune evergreens only after the first frost, and ash makes the best firewood. I write it all down. I inventory what's left of her, the spots and wrinkles, and her swollen or empty skin and flakes and rashes, and I write reminders to myself. Every day, wear sunblock. Cover your gray. Don't go insane. Eat less fats and sugars. Do more sit-ups. Don't start forgetting stuff. Trim the hair in your ears. Take calcium. Moisturize every day. Freeze time to stand in one place forever. Do not get frigging old. My mom says, Do you hear anything from my son, Victor? Do you remember him? I stop. I feel my heartache, but I've forgotten what that feeling means. Victor, my mom says, never comes to visit, and if he does, he never listens. Victor's busy and distracted, and he doesn't care. He's dropped out of medical school, she says, and he's making a big mess out of his life. My mom picks at the lint on her blanket. He's got some minimum wage kind of job as a tour guide or something, she says. She sighs, and her terrible yellow hands find the remote control. I ask, wasn't Victor looking after her? Didn't Victor have a right to a life of his own? I say maybe Victor is so busy because he's out every night, literally killing himself to pay her bills for constant care. That's $3,000 each month just to break even. Maybe that's why Victor's left school, I say, just for the sake of argument, that maybe Victor's doing his frigging best. I say it could be that Victor does more than anybody gives him credit for. And my mom smiles and says, "Oh, Fred, you're still the defender of the hopelessly guilty." My mom turns on the television, and a beautiful woman in a glittering evening dress hits another beautiful woman over the head with a bottle. The bottle doesn't even mess her hair, but it gives her amnesia. Maybe Victor is struggling with problems of his own, I say. The one beautiful woman reprograms the amnesia woman into thinking she's a killer robot that must do the beautiful woman's bidding. The killer robot accepts her new identity so easy, you have to wonder if she's just faking the amnesia and was always looking for a good reason to go on a killing spree. Me talking to my mom, my anger and resentment just sort of piddles away as we sit and watch. My mom used to serve eggs scrambled with dark flakes of the non-stick coating from the frying pan. She cooked with aluminum pots, and we drank lemonade out of spun aluminum cups while we chewed on their soft, cold lips. We used underarm deodorants made with aluminum salts. For sure, there's about a million ways we could have got to this point. During a commercial, my mom asks for just one good thing about Victor's personal life. What did he do for fun? Where did he see himself in another year, another month, another week? By now, I have no idea. And just what the hell do you mean, she says, about Victor killing himself every night? Chapter 7. After the waiter's gone, I fork up half my sirloin steak and go to cram it all in my mouth, and Denny says, "Dude," he says, "don't do it here." The people all around us, eating in their dressy clothes, with the candles and the crystal, with all the extra specialty forks, nobody suspects a thing. My lips crack trying to get around the chunk of steak, the meat salty and juicy with fat and crushed pepper. My tongue pulls back to make more room, and the drool in my mouth wells up. Hot juice and drool slop out on my chin. People who say red meat will kill you, they don't know the half of it. Denny looks around quick and he says through his teeth, says, "You're getting greedy, my friend." Denny shakes his head and says, "Dude, you can't fool people into loving you." Next to us, a married couple with wedding rings, gray hair. They eat without looking up, each of them head down, reading a program from the same play or concert. When the woman's wine is gone, she reaches for the bottle to fill her own glass. She doesn't fill his. The husband's wearing a thick gold wristwatch. Denny sees me watching the old couple, and he says, "I'll warn them, I swear." Denny watches for waiters who might know about us. He's glaring at me with his bottom teeth stuck out. The bite of steak is so big my jaws can't come together. My cheeks bulge. My lips pucker tight to close, and I have to breathe through my nose while I try to chew. The waiters in black jackets, each with a nice towel folded over one arm, the violin music, the silver and china. This isn't the normal kind of place where we'd do this, but we're running out of restaurants. There are only so many places to eat in any town, and this is for sure the kind of stunt you never repeat in the same place. I drink a little wine. At another table near us, a young couple hold hands while they eat. Maybe it will be them tonight. At another table, a man in a suit eats staring off into space. Maybe he'll be tonight's hero. I drink some wine and try to swallow, but the steak's too much. It sits in the back of my throat, and I don't breathe. In the next instant, my leg snaps straight so fast my chair flies over behind me. My hands go to gripping around my throat. I'm on my feet and gaping at the painted ceiling, my eyes rolled back. My chin stretches out away from my face. With his fork, Denny reaches over the table to steal my broccoli, and he says, "Dude, you are way overacting." Maybe it will be the 18-year-old busboy, or the corduroy guy in the turtleneck sweater, but one of these people will treasure me for the rest of their life. Already people are half out of their seats. Maybe the woman with the wrist corsage. Maybe the man with the long neck and the wire-framed glasses. This month, I got 3 birthday cards, and it's not even the 15th. Last month, I got 4. The month before, I got 6 birthday cards. Most of these people I can't remember. God bless them, but they'll never forget me. From not breathing, the veins in my neck swell, my face gets red, gets hot, sweat springs up on my forehead. Sweat blots through the back of my shirt. With my hands I hold tight around my neck, the universal sign language for someone choking to death. Even now I get birthday cards from people who don't speak English. The first few seconds, everybody is looking for someone else to step in and be the hero. Denny reaches over to steal the other half of my steak. With my hands still tight around my throat, I stagger over and kick Denny in the leg. With my hands I yank at my tie, I rip open my collar button. And Denny says, "Hey dude, that hurt." The busboy hangs back, no heroics for him. The violinist and the wine steward are neck and neck headed my way. From another direction, a woman in a short black dress is pushing through the crowd, coming to my rescue. From another direction, a man strips off his dinner jacket and charges forward. Somewhere else, a woman screams. This never takes very long. The whole adventure lasts 1-2 minutes tops. That's good, since that's about how long I can hold my breath with a mouthful of food. My first choice would be the older man with a thick gold wristwatch, somebody who will save the day and then pick up our check for dinner. My personal choice is the little black dress for the reason that she has nice tits. Even if we have to pay for our own meal, I figure you have to spend money to make money. Shoveling food into his face, Denny says, "Why you do this is so infantile." I stagger over and kick Denny again. Why I do this is to put adventure back into people's lives. Why I do this is to create heroes, put people to the test, like mother, like son. Why I do this is to make money. Somebody saves your life and they'll love you forever. It's that old Chinese custom, where if somebody saves your life, they're responsible for you forever. It's as if now you're their child. For the rest of their lives, these people will write me, send me cards on the anniversary, birthday cards. It's depressing how many people get this same idea. They call you on the phone to find out if you're feeling okay, to see if you maybe need a little cheering up, or a little cash. It's not as if I'm spending the money phoning up escort girls. Keeping my mom in St. Anthony's Care Center costs about $3,000 each month. These Good Samaritans keep me alive, I keep her alive, it's that simple. You gain power by pretending to be weak. By contrast, you make people feel so strong. You save people by letting them save you. All you have to do is be fragile and grateful, so stay the underdog. People really need somebody they feel superior to, so stay downtrodden. People need somebody they can send a check to at Christmas, so stay poor. Charity isn't the right word, but it's the first word that comes to mind. You become the proof of their courage, the proof that they were a hero, evidence of their success. I do this because everybody wants to save a human life with 100 people watching. With the sharp tip of his steak knife, Denny's sketching on the white tablecloth, sketching the architecture of the room, the cornices and paneling, the broken pediments above each doorway, all this while still chewing. Denny lifts his plate to his mouth and just shovels in the food. To perform a tracheotomy, you'd find the dent just below the Adam's apple, but just above the cricoid cartilage. With a steak knife, make a half-inch horizontal incision, then pinch the incision and insert your finger to open it. Then insert a trach tube. A drinking straw or half a ballpoint pen works best. If I can't be a great doctor saving hundreds of patients, this way I'm a great patient creating hundreds of would-be doctors. Closing in fast right now is a man in a tuxedo, dodging between the onlookers, running with his steak knife and his ballpoint pen. By choking, you become a legend about themselves that these people will cherish and repeat until they die. They'll think they gave you life. You might be the one good deed, the deathbed memory that justifies their whole existence. So be the aggressive victim, the big loser. Be a professional failure. People will jump through hoops if you just make them feel like a god. It's the martyrdom of Saint Me. Denny scrapes my plate onto his and keeps forking food into his mouth. The wine steward is here. The little black dress is up against me. The man with the thick gold wristwatch. In another minute, the arms will come around me from behind. Some stranger will be hugging me tight, double-fisting me under the ribcage and breathing into my ear. You're okay. Breathing into my ear, you're going to be fine. Two arms will hug you, maybe even lift you off your feet. And a stranger will whisper, "Breathe, breathe, damn it." Somebody will pound you on the back the way a doctor pounds a newborn baby, and you'll let fly with your mouth full of chewed steak. In the next second, you'll both be collapsed on the floor. You'll be sobbing while somebody tells you how everything is all right. You're alive. They saved you. You almost died. They'll hold your head to their chest and rock you, saying, "Everybody, get back. Make some room here. The show's over." Already, you're their child. You belong to them. They'll put a glass of water to your lips and say, "Just relax. Hush. It's all over. Hush." For years to come, this person will call and write. You'll get cards and maybe checks. Whoever it is, this person will love you. Whoever will be so proud, even if maybe your real folks aren't. This person will be proud of you because you make them so proud of themselves. You'll sip the water and cough just so the hero can wipe your chin with a napkin. Do anything to cement this new bond, this adoption. Remember to add little details. Stain their clothes with snot so they can laugh and forgive you. Cling and clutch. Really cry so they can wipe your eyes. It's okay to cry as long as you're faking it. Just don't hold anything back. This is going to be the best story of somebody's life. What's most important is, unless you want a nasty trach scar, you'd better be breathing before anybody gets near you with a steak knife, a pocket knife, a box cutter. Another detail to remember is, when you blast out your mouthful of wet crud, your ground wad of dead meat and drool, you'll need to be facing straight at Denny. Denny's got parents and grandparents, aunts and uncles and cousins up the ass. 1,000 people who have to save him from every mess-up. That's why Denny will never understand me. The rest of the people, everybody else in the restaurant, sometimes they'll stand there and applaud. People will cry with relief. People just pour out of the kitchen. Within minutes, they'll be telling the story to each other. Everybody will buy drinks for the hero, their eyes all shining with eye juice. They'll all shake the hero's hand. They'll pat the hero on the back. This is so much more their birth than it is yours. But for years to come, this person will send you a birthday card on this day and month. They'll become another member of your own very, very extended family. And Denny will just shake his head and ask for a dessert menu. That's why I do all this, go to all this trouble, to showcase just one brave stranger, to save just one more person from boredom. It's not just for the money, it's not just for the adoration, but neither one hurts. It's all so easy. It's not about looking good, at least not on the surface, but you still win. Just let yourself be broken and humiliated, just your whole life. Keep telling people, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry." Chapter 8. Eva follows me down the hallway with her pockets full of roast turkey. There's chewed up Salisbury steak in her shoes. Her face, the powdery crushed velvet mess of her skin, is 100 wrinkles that all run into her mouth, and she wheels along after me saying, "You, don't you run away from me." Her hands woven with lumpy veins, she wheels herself along. Hunched in her wheelchair, pregnant with her own huge swollen spleen, she keeps after me saying, "You hurt me," saying, "You can't deny it." Wearing a bib the color of food, she says, "You hurt me, and I'm telling Mother." Where they have my mom, she has to wear a bracelet, not a jewelry kind of bracelet. It's a strip of thick plastic that's heat-sealed around her wrist so she can never take it off. You can't cut it. You can't melt it apart with a cigarette. People have tried all these ways to get out. Wearing the bracelet, every time you walk around the hallways, you hear locks snapping shut. A magnetic strip or something sealed inside the plastic gives off a signal. It stops the elevator doors from opening for you to get on. It locks almost every door if you get within 4 feet. You can't leave the floor you're assigned. You can't get to the street. You can go into the garden or the day room or the chapel or the dining room, but nowhere else in the world. If somehow you do get past an exterior door, for sure the bracelet sets off an alarm. This is St. Anthony's. The rugs, the drapes, the beds, pretty much everything is flameproof. It's all stain resistant. You could do just about anything, anywhere, and they could just wipe it up. It's what they call a care center. It feels bad telling you all this. Spoiling the surprise, I mean. You'll see it all yourself soon enough. That is, if you live too long. Or if you just give up and go nuts ahead of time. My mom, Eva, even you. Eventually everybody gets a bracelet. This isn't one of those snake pit kind of places. You don't smell urine the minute you walk in the door. Not for $3,000 every month. It used to be a convent a century ago, and the nuns planted a beautiful old rose garden, beautiful and walled and fully escape-proof. Video security cameras watch you from every angle. From the minute you walk in the front door, there's a slow, scary migration of the residents edging towards you. Every wheelchair, all the people with walkers and canes, they all see a visitor and they come creeping. Tall, glaring Mrs. Novak is an undresser. The woman in the room next to my mom is a squirrel. With an undresser, they take their clothes off at every possible moment. These are the folks who the nurses dress in what look like shirt and pants combinations, but are really jumpsuits. The shirts are sewn into the waistband of the pants. The shirt buttons and the fly are fake. The only way in or out is a long zipper up the back. These are old people with limited range of motion, so an undresser, even what they call an aggressive undresser, is trapped three times over. In her clothes, in her bracelet, in the care center. A squirrel is someone who chews her food and then forgets what to do next. They forget how to swallow. Instead, she spits each mouthful in her dressed pocket, or in her handbag. This is less cute than it sounds. Mrs. Novak is my mom's roommate. The squirrel is Eva. At St. Anthony's, the first floor is for people who forget names and run around naked and put chewed food in their pockets, but who are otherwise pretty undamaged. Here are also some young people fried on drugs and smoked with massive head traumas. They walk and talk. Even if it's just word salad, a constant stream of words that seem random. Fig, people, road, little dawn, singing, rope, purple veil, gone. That's how they talk. The second floor is for bed patients. The third floor is where people go to die. Mom's on the first floor for now, but nobody's there forever. How Eva got here is, people will take their aging parents to public places and just leave them behind with no identification. These are old Dorothy's and Irma's with no idea who or where they are. People think the city or the state government or whoever will just collect them, kind of what the government does with litter. The same as what happens when you ditch your old car and take the license plate and the VIN decal off so the city has to tow it away. No kidding, but this is called granny dumping, and St. Anthony's has to take a certain number of dumped grannies and ecstasy-fried street kids and suicidal bag ladies. Only they don't call them bag ladies, or call the street girls prostitutes. My guess is somebody slowed their car down and just shoved Eva out the door and never shed a tear. Kind of what people do with pets they can't house train. Eva's still trailing me. I get to my mom's room and she's not there. Instead of mom, her bed's empty with a big wet dent sunk in the mattress soaked with urine. It's shower time, I figure. A nurse takes you down the hall to a big tiled room where they can hose you clean. Here at St. Anthony's, they show the movie The Pajama Game every Friday night, and every Friday all the same patients crowd in to see it for the first time. They have bingo, crafts, visiting pets. They have Dr. Paige Marshall, wherever she's disappeared to. They have fireproof bibs that cover you from your neck to your ankles so you don't set yourself on fire when you smoke. They have Norman Rockwell posters. A hairdresser comes twice a week to do your hair. That costs extra. Incontinence costs extra. Dry cleaning costs extra. Monitoring urine output costs extra. Stomach tubes. They have lessons every day in how to tie your shoes, how to button a button, snap a snap, buckle a buckle. Somebody will demonstrate Velcro. Somebody will teach you how to zip your zipper. Every morning, they tell you your name. Friends who've known each other for 60 years get reintroduced every morning. These are doctors, lawyers, captains of industry who, day to day, can't master a zipper anymore. This is less teaching than it is damage control. You might as well try to paint a house that's on fire. Here at St. Anthony's, Tuesday means Salisbury steak. Wednesday means mushroom chicken. Thursday is spaghetti. Friday, baked fish. Saturday, corned beef. Sunday, roast turkey. They have 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzles for you to do while you're running out the clock. There isn't a mattress in the place that a dozen people haven't already died on. Eva's wheeled her chair up to my mom's doorway, and she's sitting there looking pale and wilted, as if she's a mummy somebody just unwrapped and then set its thin, cruddy hair. Her curly blue head never stops bobbing in slow, tight little prizefighter circles. "Don't come near me," Eva says every time I look at her. "Dr. Marshall won't let you hurt me," she says. Until the nurse gets back, I just sit on the edge of my mom's bed and wait. My mom has one of those clocks where each hour is marked by the call of a different bird, pre-recorded. 1 o'clock is the American robin. 6 o'clock is the northern oriole. Noon is the house finch. The black-capped chickadee means 8 o'clock. The white-breasted nuthatch means 11. You get the idea. The problem is, associating birds with specific times can get confusing, especially if you're outside. You turn from a clock watcher to a bird watcher. Every time you hear the lovely trill of the white-throated sparrow, you think, is it 10 o'clock already? Eva wheels a little bit into my mom's room. "You hurt me," she says to me. "And I never told mother." These old people, these human ruins. It's already half past the tufted titmouse, and I have to catch my bus and be at work by the time the blue jay sings. Eva thinks I'm her big brother, who diddled her about a century ago. My mom's roommate, Mrs. Novak, with her big, horrible, hanging breasts, she thinks I'm her bastard business partner, who gypped her out of the patent for the cotton gin or the fountain pen or something. Here I get to be all things to all women. "You hurt me," Eva says, and she rolls a little closer. She says, "And I've never forgotten it for a minute." Every time I visit, some old raisin down the hall with wild eyebrows, she calls me Eichmann. Another woman with a clear plastic tube of piss looping out from under her bathrobe, she accuses me of stealing her dog and she wants it back. Any time I pass this other old woman, who sits in her wheelchair slumped inside a pile of pink sweaters, she hisses at me, saying, "I saw you." She looks at me with one cloudy eye, saying, "The night of the fire, I saw you with them." You can't win here. Every man who's ever passed through Eva's life has probably been her big brother in some form. Whether she knew it or not, she's spent her whole life waiting and expecting men to diddle her. For serious, even mummied up in her wrinkled skin, she's still 8 years old, stuck, just the same as Colonial Dunsborough with its granola crew of burnouts. Everybody at St. Anthony's is trapped in their past. I'm no exception, and I don't think you are either. Just as stuck as Denny in his stocks, Eva's arrested in her development. "You," Eva says, and she pokes a finger at me. "You hurt my woo-woo." These stuck old people. "Oh, you said it was just our game," Eva says, and she rolls her head, her voice getting sing-song. "It was just our secret game, and then you put your big man thing inside me." Her bony, carved little finger keeps poking in the air at my crotch. For serious, just the idea makes my big man thing want to run screaming from the room. The problem is, anywhere else at St. Anthony's, it's the same deal. Another old skeleton thinks I borrowed $500 from her. Another baggy old woman calls me the devil. "And you hurt me," Eva says. It's tough not to come here and soak up the blame for every crime in history. You want to shout in everybody's old toothless face, "Yes, I kidnapped that Lindbergh baby. That Titanic thing, I did that. The Kennedy assassination deal, yeah, that was me. The big World War II gizmo, that atomic bomb contraption, well, guess what? That was my doing. The AIDS bug, sorry, me again." The correct way to handle a case like Eva is to redirect her attention. Distract her by mentioning lunch, or the weather, or how nice her hair looks. Her attention span is about a clock tick long, and you can shove her on to a more pleasant topic. You can guess this is how men have been handling Eva's hostility for her whole life. Just distract her, get through the moment, avoid confrontation, run away. That's pretty much how we get through our whole lives, watching television, smoking crap, self-medicating, redirecting our own attention, jacking off, denial. Her whole body leaning forward, her little stick finger trembles in the air at me. Screw it. She's already pretty much engaged to become Mrs. Death. Yeah, Eva, I say, I boned you. And I yawn, yup. Every chance I got, I stuck it in you and humped out a load. They call this psychodrama. You could call it just another kind of granny dumping. Eva's little twisted finger wilts, and she settles back between the arms of her wheelchair. So you finally admit it, she says. Hell yes, I say. You're a great piece of ass, baby sis. Eva looks off at a blank spot on the linoleum floor, and she says, after all these years, he admits it. This is role-playing therapy. Only Eva doesn't know it's not for real. Her head still loops in little circles, but her eyes come back to me. And you're not sorry, she says? Well, I guess if Jesus could die for my sins, I suppose I could soak up a few for other people. We all get our chance to play scapegoat, to take the blame. This is the martyrdom of Saint Me. The sins of every man in history landing square on my back. Eva, I say, baby, sweetheart, little sister, love of my life, of course I'm sorry, I was a pig. I say, and I look at my watch. You were such a hot tamale that I was just out of control. Like I need this shit to deal with. Eva just stares at me with her big hyperthyroid eyes until a big tear splurts out of one eye and cuts through the powder on her wrinkled cheek. I roll my eyes at the ceiling and say, okay, I hurt your little woo-woo, but that was 80 frigging years ago, so get over it. Move on with your life. Then her horrible hands come up, wasted and veined as tree roots or old carrots, and they cover her face. Oh, Colin, she says behind them. Oh, Colin. Eva takes her hands away, and her face is hosed with eye juice. Oh, Colin, she whispers, I forgive you. And her face nods toward her chest, bobbing with short breaths and sniffs, and her terrible hands bring the edge of her bib up to wipe at her eyes. We just sit there. Geez, I wish I had some chewing gum. My watch says 12:35. Eva wipes her eyes and sniffs and looks up a little. Colin, she says, do you still love me? These frigging old people. Jesus H. And just in case you're wondering, I am not a monster. Just like something in a frigging book for real, I say, yeah, Eva. I say, yeah, for sure. I guess I can probably still love you. Eva sobs now, her face hanging over her lap, her whole body rocking. I'm so glad, she says, her tears dropping straight, gray stuff from her nose dropping right into her empty hands. Eva says, I'm so glad, and she's still crying, and you can smell the chewed-up Salisbury steak squirreled away in her shoe, the chewed mushroom chicken in the pocket of her smock. That and the damn nurse is never going to get my mom back from her shower, and I have to be back at work in the 18th century by 1 o'clock. It's hard enough remembering my own past so that I can do my fourth step. Now it's mixed up with the past of these other people. Which defense attorney am I today? I can't remember. I look at my fingernails. I ask Eva, is Dr. Marshall here, do you think? I ask, do you know if she's married? The truth about myself, who I really am, my father and everything, if my mother knows, then she's too freaked out with guilt to tell me. I ask Eva, could you maybe cry somewhere else? Then it's too late. The blue jay starts singing. And Eva still won't shut up, crying and rocking, her bib pressed to her face, the plastic bracelet trembling around one wrist. She's saying, I forgive you, Colin. I forgive you. I forgive you. Oh, Colin, I forgive. Chapter 9. It was one afternoon when our stupid little boy and his foster mother were in a shopping mall that they heard the announcement. This was summer, and they were shopping for back to school, the year that he was going to be in fifth grade. The year you had to wear shirts with stripes to really fit in. This was years and years ago. This was only his first foster mother. Up and down stripes, he was telling her when they heard it. The announcement. Would Dr. Paul Ward, the voice told everybody, please meet your wife in the cosmetics department of Woolworths. This was the first time the mommy had come back to claim him. Dr. Ward, please meet your wife in the cosmetics department of Woolworths. That was the secret signal. So the kid lied and said he needed to find the bathroom, and instead he went to Woolworths, and there opening boxes of hair color was the mommy. She had a big yellow wig that made her face look too small and smell like cigarettes. With her fingernails, she opened each box and took out the dark brown bottle of dye inside. She'd open another box and take out the other bottle. She put the one bottle in the other box and put it back on the shelf. She opened another box. "This one's pretty," the mommy said. She looked at the picture of a woman smiling on the box. She switched the bottle inside with another bottle. All the bottles were the same dark brown glass. Opening another box, she said, "Do you think she's pretty?" And the kid's so stupid he says, "Who?" "You know who," the mommy says. "She's young, too. I just saw the two of you looking at clothes. You were holding her hand, so don't lie." And the kid was so stupid he didn't know to just run away. He didn't begin to even think about the very definite terms of her parole or the restraining order or why she'd been in jail for the past 3 months. And switching bottles of blonde into boxes for redheads and bottles of black into boxes for blondes, the mommy said, "So do you like her?" "You mean Mrs. Jenkins?" the boy said. Not closing the boxes just perfect. The mommy was putting them back on the shelf, a little messed up, a little faster, and she said, "Do you like her?" And like this is going to help, our little stooge said, "She's just a foster mom." And not looking at the kids, still looking at the woman smiling on the box in her hand, the mommy said, "I asked if you liked her." A shopping cart rattled up next to them in the aisle, and a blonde lady reached past to take a box with a blonde picture but a bottle of some other color inside it. This woman put the box in her cart and got away. "She thinks of herself as a blonde," the mommy said. "What we have to do is mess with people's little identity paradigms. What the mommy used to call beauty industry terrorism." The little boy looked after the lady until she was too far away to help. "You already have me," the mommy said. "So what do you call this foster one?" "Mrs. Jenkins." "And do you like her?" the mommy said, and turned to look at him for the first time. And the little boy pretended to make up his mind and said, "No." "Do you love her?" "No." "Do you hate her?" And this spineless little worm said, "Yes." And the mommy said, "You got that right." She leaned down to look him in the eyes, and she said, "How much do you hate Mrs. Jenkins?" And the little coo said, "Lots and lots." "And lots and lots and lots," the mommy said. She put her hand for him to take and said, "We have to be fast. We have a train to catch." Then leading him through the aisles, tugging his boneless little arm toward daylight outside the glass doors, the mommy said, "You are mine, mine, now and forever, and don't you ever forget it." And pulling him through the doors, she said, "And just in case the police or anybody asks you later on, I'm going to tell you all the dirty, filthy things this so-called foster mom did to you every time she could get you alone." Chapter 10. Where I live now, in my mom's old house, I sort through my mom's papers, her college report cards, her deeds, statements, accounts, court transcripts, her diary still locked, her entire life. The next week, I'm Mr. Benning, who defended her on the little charge of kidnapping after the school bus incident. The week after, I'm public defender Thomas Welton, who plea bargained her sentence down to 6 months after she was charged with assaulting the animals in the zoo. After him, I'm the American civil liberties attorney who went to bat with her on the malicious mischief charge stemming from the disturbance at the ballet. There's an opposite to déjà vu. It's called jamais vu. It's when you meet the same people or visit places again and again, but each time is the first. Everybody is always a stranger. Nothing is ever familiar. "How is Victor doing?" my mom asks me on my next visit. Whoever I am, whatever public defender du jour. "Victor who?" I want to ask. "You don't want to know," I say. "It would break your heart." I ask her, "What was Victor like as a little boy? What did he want from the world? Did he have any big goal he dreamed about?" At this point, how my life starts to feel is like I'm acting in a soap opera, being watched by people on a soap opera, being watched by people on a soap opera, being watched by real people somewhere. Every time I visit, I watch the halls for another chance to talk with a doctor with her little black brain of hair, her ears and glasses. Dr. Paige Marshall, with her clipboard and her attitude, her scary dreams about helping my mom live another 10 or 20 years. Dr. Paige Marshall, another potential dose of sexual anesthetic. See also Nico. See also Tanya. See also Lisa. More and more, it feels like I'm doing a really bad impersonation of myself. My life makes about as much sense as a Zen koan. A house wren sings, but whether it's a real bird or it's 4 o'clock, I'm not sure. My memory isn't any good, my mom says. She's rubbing her temples with the thumb and index finger of one hand and says, I worry that I should tell Victor the truth about himself. Propped on her stack of pillows, she says, before it's too late, I wonder if Victor has a right to know who he really is. So just tell him, I say. I bring food, a bowl of chocolate pudding, and try to sneak the spoon into her mouth. I can go call, I say, and Victor can be here in a couple of minutes. The pudding is lighter brown and smelly under a cold, dark brown skin. Oh, but I can't, she says. The guilt is so bad. I can't even face him. I don't even know how he'll react. She says, maybe it's better Victor never finds out. So tell me, I say. Get it off your chest. I say, and I promise not to tell Victor, not unless she says it's okay. My mom squints at me, her old skin all cinching tight around her eyes. With chocolate pudding smeared in the wrinkles around her mouth, she says, but how do I know I can trust you? I'm not even sure who you are. I smile and say, of course you can trust me. And I stick the spoon in her mouth. The black pudding just sits on her tongue. It's better than a stomach tube. Okay, it's cheaper. I take the remote control out of her reach and I tell her, swallow. I tell her, you have to listen to me. You have to trust me. I say, I'm him. I'm Victor's father. And her milky eyes swell at me while the rest of her face, her wrinkles and skin, seem to slide into the collar of her nightgown. With one terrible yellow hand, she makes the sign of the cross and her mouth hangs open to her chest. Oh, you're him, and you've come back, she says. Oh, blessed Father, holy Father, she says. Oh, please forgive me. Chapter 11. This is me talking to Denny, locking him in the stocks again, this time for having a stamp on the back of his hand from some nightclub, and I say, dude, I say, it's so weird. Denny's got both hands in place for me to lock them. He's got his shirt tucked in tight. He knows to bend his knees a little to take the stress off his back. He remembers to visit the restroom before he gets locked up. Our Denny's turned into a regular expert on getting punished. In good old colonial Dunsborough, masochism is a valuable job skill. It is on most jobs. Yesterday at St. Anthony's, I tell Denny, it was the same as that old movie where there's a guy and a painting, and the guy gets to party and live to be about 100 years old, and he never looks any different. The painting of him, it keeps getting uglier and trashed with alcohol-related everything, and the nose falls off from secondary syphilis and the clap. All the residents at St. Anthony's, now they're all eyes closed and humming. Everybody's all smiling and righteous. Except me. I'm their stupid painting. Congratulate me, dude, Denny says. Being in the stocks so much, I put together 4 weeks of sobriety. For sure that's like 4 weeks more than I've had since I was 13. My mom's roommate, I tell him, Mrs. Novak, she's all nodding and satisfied now that I've finally fessed up to stealing her invention for toothpaste. Another old lady is jabbering and happy as a parrot since I admitted to peeing in her bed every night. Yeah, I tell them all, I did it. I burned down your house. I bombed your village. I deported your sister. I sold you a shitty blue Nash Rambler in 1968. Then, yeah, I killed your dog. So get over it. I tell them, keep it on me. Make me play the big passive bottom in your guilt gangbang. I'll take everybody's load. And after everybody's humped out their load in my face, they're all smiling and humming. They're laughing at the ceiling, still all crowded around me, patting my hand and saying it's all right. They forgive me. They're gaining fucking weight. The whole hen party's chattering at me. And this real tall nurse walks by and she says, well, aren't you Mr. Popular? Denny sniffs. You need the snot rag, dude, I say. The weird part is my mom's not getting any better. No matter how much I play Pied Piper and take the blame away from these people, no matter how much fault I sponge up, my mom doesn't believe that I'm me anymore, that I'm Victor Mancini. So she won't unload her own big secret, so she's going to need some stomach tube thing. Sobriety is okay enough, Denny says, but someday I'd like to live a life based on doing good stuff instead of just not doing bad stuff, you know? What's even weirder, I tell him, is I'm figuring how I can turn my new popularity into a fast broom closet ram session with this tall nurse, maybe get her to throw my dog. A nurse thinks you're a caring, nurturing guy who's patient with hopeless old people, and you're halfway to boning her. See also Karen, RN. See also Nanette, LPN. See also Jolene, LPN. But no matter who I'm with, my head's inside this other girl, this Dr. Page something, Marshall. So no matter who I'm boning, I have to think about big infected animals, big roadkill raccoons all swollen up with gas and getting hit by fast trucks on the highway on a blistering day in the sun. Either that or I trigger right away. That's how hot this Dr. Marshall is in my head. It's funny how you never think about the women you've had. It's always the ones who get away that you can't forget. It's just that my internal addict is so strong, Denny says, that I'm afraid to not be locked up. My life needs to be about more than just not jerking off. Other women, I say, no matter who, you can imagine them getting rammed. You know, straddling the driver's seat in some car, her G-spot, the back of her urethral sponge, getting hammered on by your fat, hot slider. Or you can see her bent over the edge of a hot tub getting plugged. You know, her and her private life. But this Dr. Paige Marshall, she seems to be above getting boned. Some kind of vultury birds are circling overhead. According to bird time, that makes it about 2 o'clock. A gust of wind throws the tails of Denny's waistcoat up over his shoulders, and I pull them back down. Sometimes, Denny says, and he sniffs, it's like I want to be beaten and punished. It's okay if there isn't a God anymore, but I still want to respect something. I don't want to be the center of my own universe. With Denny in the stocks all afternoon, I have to split all the firewood. By myself, I have to grind the corn, salt the pork, candle the eggs. The cream needs to be dipped, the hogs slopped. You wouldn't think the 18th century would be so hectic. With me picking up all the slack for him, I tell Denny's hunched back, the least he could do is visit my mom and pretend to be me, to hear her confession. Denny sighs at the ground. From 200 feet up, one of the vulture birds drops a nasty white dump on his back. Denny says, dude, what I need is a mission. I say, so do this one good thing, help out an old lady. And Denny says, how's your number 4 step coming along? He says, dude, I have an itch on my side, can you help me out? And careful of the bird crap, I start scratching him. Chapter 12. In the phone book, there's more and more red ink. More and more restaurants are crossed out in red felt-tip pen. These are all places where I almost died. Italian, Mexican, Chinese places. For real, every night I have fewer options for where to eat out if I want to make any money. If I want to trick anyone into loving me. The question is always, so what do you feel like choking on tonight? There's French food, Mayan food, East Indian. For where I live in my mom's old house, picture a really dirty antique store, the kind where you have to walk sideways, the way you'd walk in Egyptian hieroglyphics. It's that kind of crowded. All the furniture carved out of wood, the long dining room table, the chairs and chests and cabinets with faces carved on everything. The furniture's all oozed over with some thick syrup kind of varnish that turned black and crackled about 1 million years before Christ. Covering the bulgy sofas is that bulletproof kind of tapestry you'd never want to sit on naked. Every night after work, first there's the birthday cards to go through, the checks to total. This is spread out across the black acre of dining room table, my base of operations. Here's the next day's deposit slip to fill out. Tonight, it's one lousy card. One crapmo card comes in the mail with a check for $50. That's still a thank you note I have to write. There's still the groveling next generation of underdog letters to write. It's not that I'm an ingrate, but if all you can cut me is $50, next time just let me die, okay? Or better yet, stand aside and let some rich person be the hero. For sure I can't write that in a thank you note, but still. From my mom's house, Picture all this castle furniture crammed into a two-bedroom newlywed house. These sofas and paintings and clocks are all supposed to be her dowry from the old country, from Italy. My mom came here for college and never went back after she had me. She's not Italian in any way you'd notice, no garlic smell or big armpit hair. She came here to attend medical school, frigging medical school in Iowa. The truth is, immigrants tend to be more American than people born here. The truth is, I'm more or less her green card. Looking through the phone book, what I need to do is to take my act to a classier audience. You have to go where the money is and bring it home. Don't be choking to death on chicken nuggets and some deep-fried joint. Rich people eating French food want to be the hero as much as anybody else. My point is, discriminate. My advice to you is, identify your target market. In the phone book, there's still fish houses to try, Mongolian grills. The name on today's check is some woman who saved my life in a smorgasbord last April. One of those all-you-can-eat buffets. What was I thinking? Choking in cheap restaurants is for sure a false economy. It's all worked out, all the details, in the big book I keep. Here's everything from who saved me where and when to how much they have spent so far. Today's donor is Brenda Monroe, signed at the bottom of her birthday card, with love. I hope this little bit helps, she's written across the bottom of the check. Brenda Monroe, Brenda Monroe. I try, but I don't get a face, nothing. Nobody can expect you to remember every near-death experience. For sure, I should keep better notes, hair and eye color at least, but for real, look at me here. As it is, I'm already drowning in paperwork. Last month's thank you letter was all about my struggle to pay for, I forget what. It was rent I told people I needed, or dental work. It was to pay for milk or counseling. By the time I send out a couple hundred of the same letter, I never want to read it again. It's a homegrown version of those overseas children's charities. These are the ones where, for the price of a cup of coffee, you could save a child's life. Be a sponsor. The hook is you can't just save somebody's life one time. People are having to save me again and again. The same as real life. There is no happily ever after. The same as in medical school. You can only save somebody so many times before you can't. It's the Peter principle of medicine. These people sending money, they're paying for heroism in installments. There's Moroccan food to choke on. There's Sicilian every night. After I was born, my mom just stayed put in the States, not in this house. She didn't live here until her last release, after the school bus theft charge, auto theft and kidnapping. This isn't any house I remember from childhood, or this furniture. This is everything her parents sent from Italy, I guess. She could have won it on a game show for all I really know. Just once, I asked her about her family, my grandparents back in Italy, and she said, this I remember, she said, they don't know about you, so don't make any trouble. And if they don't know about her bastard child, it's a safe bet they don't know about her obscenity conviction, her attempted murder conviction, her reckless endangerment, her animal harassment. It's a safe bet they're insane, too. Just look at their furniture. They're probably insane and dead. I flip back and forth through the phone book. The truth is it costs $3,000 a month to keep my mom at St. Anthony's Care Center. At St. Anthony's, $50 gets you about one diaper change. God only knows how many deaths I'll have to die before I can pay for a stomach tube. The truth is, so far the Big Book of Heroes has just over 300 names recorded in it, and I still don't pull in $3,000 every month. Plus there's the waiter every night with a bill. Plus there's the tip. The damn overhead is killing me. The same as any good pyramid scheme, you always have to be enrolling people at the bottom. The same as Social Security, it's a mass of good people all paying for somebody else. Nickel and diming these good Samaritans is just my own personal social safety net. Ponzi scheme isn't the right phrase, but it's the first one that comes to mind. The miserable truth is, every night I still have to pick through the telephone directory to find a good place to almost die. What I'm running is the Victor Mancini telethon. It's no worse than the government. Only in the Victor Mancini welfare state, the people who foot the bill don't complain. They're proud. They actually brag to their friends. It's a gifting scam with just me at the top and new members lined up to buy in by hugging me from behind. Bleeding these good, generous people is. Still, it's not like I'm spending the money on drugs and gambling. It's not like I even get to finish a meal anymore. Halfway through every main course, I have to go to work, do my gagging and thrashing. Even then, some people never come across with any money. Some never seem to give it another thought. After long enough, even the most generous people will stop sending a check. The crying part, where I am hugged in somebody's arms, gasping and crying, that part just gets easier and easier. More and more, the hardest part of crying is when I can't stop. Not crossed out in the phone book, there's still fondue, there's Thai, Greek, Ethiopian, Cuban. There's still 1,000 places I haven't gone to die. To increase cash flow, you have to create 2 or 3 heroes every night. Some nights you have to hit 3 or 4 places before you've had a full meal. I'm a performance artist doing dinner theater, doing 3 shows a night. Ladies and gentlemen, may have a volunteer from the audience. Thank you, but no thank you, I'd like to tell my dead relatives, but I can build my own family. Fish, meat, vegan, tonight, like most nights, the easiest way is just to close my eyes. Hold your finger over the open phone book. Step right up and become a hero, ladies and gentlemen. Step right up and save a life. Just let your hand drop and just let fate decide for you. Chapter 13. Because of the heat, Denny strips off his coat, then his sweater. Without undoing the buttons, even the cuffs of the collar one, he pulls his shirt off over his head inside out. So now his head and hands are bagged in red plaid flannel. The t-shirt underneath works up around his armpits while he's fighting the shirt off his head, and his bare stomach looks rashy and caved in. Some long, twisted hairs sprout around his little dot nipples. His nipples look cracked and sore. Dude, Denny says, still struggling inside his shirt. Too many layers. Why's it got to be so hot in here? Because it's a kind of hospital, I say. A constant care residence. Over his jeans and belt, you can see the dead, elastic waistband of his bad underpants. Orange rust stains show on the loose elastic. In front, a few coiled hairs poke out. There's yellowy sweat stains on, for real, his underarm skin. The front desk girl is sitting right here, watching with her face all bunched up tight around her nose. I try and tug his t-shirt back down, and there's for sure many colors of lint in his navel. At work in the locker room, I've seen Denny pull his pants off inside out with the underpants still on them, the way I did when I was little. And still with his head wrapped up in his shirt, Denny goes, "Dude, can you help me? There's a button somewhere so I don't know about." The front desk girl is giving me her look. She's got the telephone receiver halfway to her ear. With most of his clothes on the floor next to him, Denny gets skinnier until he's down to just his sour t-shirt and his jeans with dirt on each knee. His tennis shoes are double knotted, with the knots and eye holes glued forever with dirt. It's somewhere around 100 degrees here, because most of these people don't have any circulation, I tell him. It's a lot of old folks here. It smells clean, which means you only smell chemicals, cleaning stuff, or perfumes. You have to know the pine smell is covering up shit somewhere. Lemon means somebody vomited. Roses are urine. After an afternoon at St. Anthony's, you never want to smell another rose for the rest of your life. The lobby has stuffed furniture and fake plants and flowers. This decorator stuff will peter out after you get beyond the locked doors. To the front desk girl, Denny says, "Will anybody mess with my stuff if I just leave it here?" He means the pile of his old clothes. He says, "I'm Victor Mancini." He looks at me and says, "I'm here to see my mom." To Denny, I go, "Dude, geez, she's not the one with brain damage." To the desk girl, I say, "I'm Victor Mancini. I'm here all the time to see my mom, Ida Mancini. She's in room 158. The girl presses a phone button and says, "Paging Nurse Remington. Nurse Remington to the front desk, please." Her voice comes out huge through the ceiling. You have to wonder if Nurse Remington is a real person. You have to wonder if maybe this girl thinks Denny's just another aggressive chronic undresser. Denny goes to kick his clothes under a stuffed chair. A fat man comes jogging down the hall with one hand pressed over a bouncing chest full of pens and another hand on his hip holster of hot pepper spray. Keys jingle on his other hip. "To the front desk girl," he says. "So what's the situation here?" And Denny says, "Is there a bathroom I can use, like, for civilians?" The problem is Denny. So he'll hear her confession. He needs to meet what's left of my